Hello, and thank you for listening to this week's Public Sector Inc. podcast. I'm Josh Barrow of the Manhattan Institute, and this week I'm interviewing Mark Levin, author of States Are Making the Right Corrections. Mark is the director of the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation and a leader of the foundation's Right on Crime project. He's also a prominent thinker on corrections reform issues in the states. Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit about Right on Crime and about the work that you guys do at TPPF on corrections reform?
Sure. Well, we began working on this issue in 2005, and over that time, we've been able to work with policymakers here in Texas to enact reforms that have reduced crime while also controlling costs to taxpayers. And then in December of 2010, we launched the Right on Crime Initiative, where conservative leaders have come together to say conservatives need to be tough and smart when it comes to criminal justice. And we've released a statement of principles, which is at rightoncrime.com, signed by Newt Gingrich, Bill Bennett, the former drug czar Ed Meese, former Attorney General Grover Norquist, and many other prominent conservative leaders.
And so broadly, the sorts of reforms that you're promoting have to do with, you know, increased use of non-custodial sentences, improvements to probation and parole, things like that. Is that an accurate description?
Yes, I think so. I mean, we've, you know, certainly recognize there's a role for incarcerating dangerous offenders, and we don't subscribe to kind of the liberal 60s paradigm, which was, you know, if it feels good, do it, and society's responsible for crime and not individuals. We certainly believe in personal responsibility, but also in limited government, that we should use the least costly sanction that's necessary to protect public safety, and also emphasize victims and restoring them, making sure they get restitution. Those have been some of the efforts that we've worked on.
I think one thing that's interesting, especially for readers here at Public Sector Inc., is the role that vested interest groups play in the debate over corrections reform. You know, like any other government program, corrections costs money and creates interests in people who have jobs that are associated with current structure. What sort of resistance are you seeing from groups? I mean, because a lot of the policies that you propose will result in things like closing prisons, employing fewer prison employees. You have state legislators whose districts are heavily dependent on employment in prisons. What sort of pushback are you getting from those kind of groups, and how do you effectively respond to it?
Well, there is pushback, you know, all over the country, both from public employee unions as well as vested interest communities who are concerned about the job losses if an institution closes. But certainly, I think it's absolutely essential that conservatives say we need as much spending as necessary to protect public safety, but we don't want, just like we wouldn't want welfare offices to exist just as jobs programs, we don't want prisons to exist just as jobs programs. You know, here in Texas, when we made substantial reforms in juvenile justice that emphasized community-based initiatives, and we've seen juvenile crime go down since those changes were made, it did result in closing some state lockups in remote areas, and legislators from those districts fought that tooth and nail. And as you alluded to, we've seen in California, the Prison Guards Union has spent $30 million on political campaigns, a couple million just for Gray Davis, and they have been at every turn opposing reforms and supporting policies that would incarcerate more even nonviolent offenders. So I think that it's a major issue, and the best way to address it is to say we're on the side of taxpayers, we're on the side of doing what's good policy, even if it means ruffling a few feathers.
I thought you had an interesting story about what our new governor here in New York, Andrew Cuomo, was up to, this prison visit that he did pretty much immediately after his inauguration.
Yes, literally the first thing he did was go to a juvenile lockup in upstate New York, and there are no youths there today, but there's 30 employees. And he cited that as an example of government waste, and he noted that there's a state law that says that these staff have to be employed for at least 12 months, even after the institution is closed. And so this is, you know, tough on taxpayers, if you will. And so, you know, and then in his State of State address, he made this point very strongly that we shouldn't use incarceration as a jobs program. And according to the New York Times, got the loudest ovation of any line in his speech.
Well, that's heartening. So why don't you talk a little bit about where these reforms have been successful, both in improving social outcomes and reducing crime rates, but also in producing cost savings? I know that you guys have done a lot of work in Texas, and Texas has been sort of a leader in this area, moving out ahead of a lot of other states.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what we've seen is in Texas, really the impetus came in January of 2007 when the state was projected to need another 17,000 prison beds. And we already had at that time the second highest incarceration rate in the nation and 155,000 prison beds. So rather than just you know, say we'll spend $2 billion to build and operate more prisons, which is what it would have cost over 5 years, we worked with policymakers here to put together alternatives. And some of those were, you know, short-term treatment-oriented incarceration for nonviolent offenders, but that would address their drug habit. But also many of them were strengthening probation, and where you have, for example, graduated sanctions, so that each time a probationer misses an appointment, there's a swift, sure, commensurate response. Don't just wait for the violations to pile up and then revoke someone for 10 years. So we did drug courts and other smart mental health diversions, things that really made sense. And we've seen since the implementation, our crime rate's the lowest it's been since 1973, and we've saved, you know, well over $1 billion. So Arizona's also instituted, I think, what's an excellent model of performance-based probation funding. You know, in corrections, typically, it's a system that grows when it fails, and we would like to see a system that rewards results. And in the Arizona model, probation departments reduce both new crimes by probationers and revocations to prison. They get, you know, more funding than those that don't. And so that's, since that was implemented in December of 2008, they have seen a reduction in both new crimes by probationers and revocations of probationers to prison. And of course, that saved the state money.
Yeah, this sort of has, for me, echoes of the CompStat program that's used here in New York City, where the starting in the Giuliani administration with Bill Bratton running the police department, the police became very focused on using very quantitative data analyses to analyze performance and reward good performance. And obviously, as you mentioned in the piece, we talk about the importance of doing this for teachers. And I think your approach is basically about taking that also to the corrections world and saying, you know, well, let's look at the numbers and understand what's really working and reward the things that are successful.
No, that's a great analogy. And, you know, you don't measure success of a program, whatever, whether it's in law enforcement or education or corrections, by volume, how many people are employed or how many people are supervised. You measure it by what are the outcomes taxpayers want and what's the purpose of this program. And then clearly in criminal justice, we want lower recidivism, reoffending. We want lower positive tests for drugs among those offenders participating. We want a greater percentage of offenders paying restitution. We want more who get a job, whether they're on probation or after they come out of prison. And so those are the kind of results we need to incentivize.
So how big a deal is this for taxpayers? You mentioned saving over $1 billion in Texas, which certainly sounds like a lot of money. When you compare this to, you know, education and Medicaid and other areas that are driving big increases in state budgets and that are being talked about in discussions all around the country as states try to close large budget gaps, how significant a role does this play in those discussions? Is this an important part of moves in states to make their budgets sustainable, or is this mostly an issue of effectiveness with the dollar numbers not being the, you know, the key issue?
Well, I think it absolutely is a key fiscal issue because it's been the second fastest growing expenditure in state budgets over the last decade after Medicaid. And unlike Medicaid, states have a lot of control over it. You know, thankfully, it's still mostly free of federal mandates. And so that makes it a key area. Certainly, it's different from some other areas in the sense that as conservatives, we recognize public safety, just like national defense. Those are some of the few core roles of government. But I think that, you know, and obviously when we look at policy options, we're looking at those that both, you know, give us more public safety for every dollar we spend, and we're not going to do things just because they save money. So I think it's, you know, but putting all that together, certainly the budget crises facing many states are, we're seeing Mitch Daniels, Bobby Jindal, other conservative governors, Rick Scott in Florida, that they're all putting this reforms, corrections reforms on high on their agenda for these upcoming legislative sessions. And so certainly I think the fiscal crisis in the states can be a impetus and a incentive to do what's right when it comes to corrections policy.
Great. Well, this will certainly be something to watch in the 2011 legislative sessions around the country. I want to thank Mark Levin for joining us and all of you for listening to the podcast. Thanks very much.